Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, editors Nina Bennett and Marie Bennett discuss rediscovering and reprinting 1920s author Gertrude Beasley's banned memoir, My First 30 Years. They are joined by Beasley scholar Dr. Celia Marshick, professor of English at Stony Brook University. This conversation originally took place December 8th, 2021, and was recorded live via Zoom. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Thank you for coming to this online program of the American Writers Museum. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director at the AWM. At the AWM, it's our mission to explore the influence writers and their works have had on our history, our culture, and our daily lives. Our permanent exhibits and programs feature many familiar names, but they also feature writers whose work was influential or revelatory, but who, for many reasons, are not widely known or read. Tonight's program highlights one of those writers. In 1925, a feminist memoir was published abroad with an initial print run of just 500 copies. Its subjects, rape, child abuse, birth control, poverty, socialism, and the injustices of a society that shamed women for all the violence perpetrated upon them. Gertrude Beasley's My First 30 Years was banned in America, and the author was disappeared by a modern American literary tradition that was making room for shocking, candid words, most of them from men. A century would pass before her book was republished and her memory reclaimed by a country ready to hear her prophetic warnings. Here tonight to discuss Beasley's rediscovered memoir and the shocking response to its publication are editors Nina and Marie Bennett, along with Beasley scholar Dr. Celia Marshick, professor of English at Stony Brook University. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Is there anything that you would like to say, Allison, or can we start our fun conversation, which we basically all get together and nerd out about how amazing Gertrude is and how saddening it is that no one knew about her until relatively recently.
I'll happily leave you to that conversation. Please do start there.
Excellent. I was trying to ask myself the question of how did I first become so gripped by Gertrude Beasley's story? What was it that really captured me? Because I want to ask that question of Celia, because we've actually never met up until this conversation, even though I have totally fangirled her for almost a year now. So this is very exciting for me. But before asking her that question, I wanted to figure out, well, what would my answer to that question be? Why is it that I find Gertrude's story and her book so compelling? And I realized that partly it's because there's so many different entry points. There's so many different pieces that you can latch onto and get really excited about. I mean, here was a woman who refused to fit in. Here was a book that told extremely uncomfortable truths that you weren't allowed to say, either frankly then or now. Here was a story of erasure. You know, it's, in some days, it's not quite a witch hunt because there wasn't the hunting. It was like the witch burning, like just taken out of the world, her writing, her talent, you know, just completely erased. And then this wonderful story of rediscovery. And my favorite part about the rediscovery story is that it's the heroes of the rediscovery story are all nerds, right? Like these are librarians, these are literature professors, these are random people who like to spend their weekend and use bookstores. It's appealing to so many different aspects of people who love to read and people who love authors in all of their iconoclastic flamboyance. So that was my answer. Celia, I would love to hear from you about how did you first discover Gertrude and what was it about her that meant that you just couldn't let go?
Well, you know, I feel like this is perhaps we're in recovery from discovering Gertrude, right? Because when you discover her, she just takes you down this path. But I came across her in probably 2004 or 2005. I was researching a book on censorship and I was reading magazines or newsletters published by a British Vigilance Association. And by vigilance, they basically meant pressuring the government to crack down harder on vice. And there was this little article about an American author who had been arrested because the Postal Service had seized, the British Postal Office had seized proofs in the mail of an obscene book. And, you know, and they couldn't really, you know, get her in trouble because the book hadn't been published yet, but she hadn't registered with the local agency saying, you know, I'm an American citizen, I'm living in Britain. So she got in trouble for violating the Aliens Act, which I just love. Gertrude is alien. So when I got back to the US, I got the Book Club of Texas version of this book, which is one of the previous versions that was printed, and read it and discovered that she had spent the last part of her life just down the road from where I live. So I'm at Stony Brook University, which is on Long Island. Long Island was home to four enormous New York State mental hospitals because it was close, right? So you could ship people out there. And she spent, you know, the rest of her life basically 12 miles from where I live. Mm-hmm. And so that's really how I got interested in Gertrude, was just thinking about this crazy thing that had happened to her and then knowing that she'd ended her life so close to where I live mine now.
I mean, that's just incredible, right? You know, so for those who don't know, but can probably guess by our last names, Marie and I are from the same family. She is my sister-in-law. And I first discovered Gertrude Beasley through I really should have it just at my at arm's grasp, through an anthology, a Norton's anthology of Lone State literature written by a recently deceased a literature professor at UT Austin about Texas literature. I had just moved to Dallas and I wanted to, I was aware that there's a lot of mythology around the West and around Texas in particular. And I wanted to understand, what do Texans say about themselves and all the different multifaceted pieces of Texas identity? And I picked up a copy of his anthology in a used bookstore, and he had included the first 10 pages from the 1989 republication. And I was just like, wait a minute, what? I mean, her prose was so dark and so powerful. You know, I need to acquire this book. And that's when I found out that at the time it was 2019, you still couldn't get a copy. Like, unless you went to a university library or just stocked all the used bookstores online. What happened in our family is I then stocked that used bookstore, ordered a copy of the book. I didn't even order it and have it shipped to myself. I ordered and have it shipped to Marie, my sister-in-law. We are lucky enough to be part of a family that is in the publishing business. Mm-hmm. And this is right when COVID was hitting. My sister-in-law Marie is a musician, so her whole world was turned upside down. And basically this was me knocking at her door and saying, you know, would you mind helping me put this back out into the universe? You know, Marie, something I'd love for you to share is, unlike Celia or me, you are a born and bred Chicago resident, right? Like, you grew up in Hyde Park. You are an alum of the Chicago public school system. You know, so there's this whole passage in Gertrude's book that's all about Chicago. It's all about the educational system. It's all about all the different institutional problems with that and one woman's attempt to fight those institutional problems. I'd love to hear your perspective as a born and raised Chicagoan. What was it like to read about that?
Well, I think it was really interesting. Some of the, you know, issues that she mentioned were interesting to read about. You know, again, I did K through 12, you know, in the Chicago public school system in Hyde Park. And there were problems with the Chicago public school system, you know, and viewing it then from a student perspective, you know, and it never occurred to me I could do anything to change any of the problems or you just were there in school and you went to school and you sort of dealt with whatever you had to deal with. So, but it was interesting reading about that from a different, sort of an educator's perspective, and also from a different time period, but talking about the same sort of school system that I grew up in was interesting.
I have two questions that I've been dying to ask both of you. and I'm gonna go with the one that Allison's probably not gonna be as interested in first, but I'm just gonna go there. You're both university instructors. Gertrude has a lot to say about teaching and about being a student in a university in this whole first generation setting and feeling out of her depth, out of place. There's this great context. She comes from, you know, the wilds of Texas, shows up in Chicago and is just like, you know, very much adjusting and how difficult that was. She spends a lot of time talking about how difficult it is to put yourself through school while working full time. And then of course, that's as a student, she has a ton to say as a professor, you know, between her disciplinary methods, between fighting with administrators. I mean, I would love to hear you all reflect as in some ways, almost colleagues 100 years later, mm-hmm. What if you were to sit down with a beer as a, you know, colleague with Gertrude, what would you start talking about?
Well, I think it's fascinating that you mentioned the fact that she's a first generation college student. And not only that, but it's not clear that either of her parents had really even rudimentary educations, right? And she's one of 13 children. And I think she's the only one, at least in the memoir that we know of, who goes to school. So she's really a fish out of water. And on the one hand, you see her doing what a lot of first generation students do, which is they realize that is their opportunity, right? So she really seizes it. I mean, when she talks about how hard she works, you know, you can just see her realizing that this is her ticket and she might never get another ticket again. And at the same time, you can also see she often talks about wanting to keep a little distance between herself and her fellow students. And, you know, I think she's a little afraid of letting the people around her know who she really is, right? Because the University of Chicago at that point, to be there from her background, I mean, she must have some days thought she was dreaming, you know, except that she was working so hard, as you're pointing out. And her opinions about, you know, the school system are pretty interesting. I mean, I love when she talks about, you know, mostly preferring to work for women, although not always, you know, but mostly preferring to work for women. But Gertrude also has a real anti-authoritarian streak, which is funny because she was such an authoritarian in her one-room schoolhouse, right? I mean, oh, her physical discipline of students, that's one of the kind of cringeworthy parts of the book. And she has a really hard time bowing to authority and other people. So I think it's just, you know, you see somebody who has an opportunity and is enjoying the increasing sort of status and power she's got, and yet really not quite sure how to navigate when other people have power over her. That's what I would say. And I would be really curious to ask her, like, you know, looking back, what do you think about the way you disciplined your students or the way you tried to deal with, you know, this issue with the superintendent of your school?
Yeah, and I think the first generation student thing is very interesting with Gertrude, because you know, I teach a lot of first generation students. I teach at a couple colleges here in the, you know, western suburbs of Chicago. And, you know, most of the first generation students that I have currently and have taught in the past, they in general have really supportive families who just may not understand what they're doing and why it takes this much time and why they can't help out as much at home and all of those things. But I think it's definitely a different situation because it's not like Gertrude had a lot of support from her family. Like they all sort of scoffed at her educational, you know, desires from a really young age. You know, they wouldn't let her go to school and she would cry and beg to go to, you know, second grade or third grade or whatever it is. So from a very early age, she was pretty gung-ho on education. And I think, you know, there's a great scene in Chicago where her mother's coming to visit and she's really torn between, you know, very excited to see her mother. And she does love her mother despite the whole difficult family situation there. But she's also, I think, deeply ashamed of her family and of her mother. And here's this, you know, new community that she has at, you know, the University of Chicago, who don't know as much about her background. I mean, they know she's from Texas, but they don't know a lot about her background. She's not sharing that. And I think she's sort of worried that, oh no, when my mom comes to visit, my new community is going to see my mom and they're going to learn this thing about me and my family that I don't want them to know. So she's very, you know, I think shameful of her family for good reason, I will say. She's...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of why, as a 21st century reader, I was really caught in her grips. I have kept thinking about and finding new layers. The more I talk about it, the more, you know, we've been lucky enough since Sourcebooks reissued it for Banned Books Week in at the end of September, we've been lucky enough that there's been enough curiosity that we've gotten to talk with a number of people about it. And every single conversation I have helps me like to dig an additional layer that I hadn't thought about previously. One of the conversations that we had led me to realize that, oh, this is what it looks like to have someone process childhood trauma. You know, you have this childhood trauma. She's writing this in her early 30s. You can see how her narrative voice changes from the time that she's narrating in Texas, and she's just angry, like violently, unapologetically angry. And then she transitions to recounting her adult experiences, and it's this blend of shame and ambition and feeling like she doesn't belong. Like someone's going to catch her out, like total imposter syndrome, all of these things that we now have the vocabulary for and we can recognize and empathize with, but that very much at the time was, I mean, she was treading new ground. There weren't a lot of other cultural narratives to help her make sense of what she was experiencing, either in the new world and new identity she was creating for herself, or the retrospective trauma that she was going to have to deal with. Celia, I've been dying to ask you, as someone who literally spends your life on like modernism and modernist literature, I appreciate Gertrude as a reader. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about her voice and what place she, how does she compare, but what role does she play within the rest of the modernist canon, particularly that, you know, mid-20s Paris American, we're just trying to do everything crazy era?
So, you know, one of the things I love about her story is that her original publisher, the editor of Contact Editions, when he publishes his own memoir, he lists her alongside Hemingway and Gertrude Stein. And, you know, I mean, when you see the company she's in and he's writing his memoir, you know, in the 30s, I think, you know, it looks like she belonged. But when you look back at it, you realize why, how she really is unique. I mean, you know, you can't really just slot her into modernism. I mean, modernism prides itself on telling all kinds of truths that hadn't been taught before, right? But if you read like a D.H. Lawrence, right, who is also going to tell you about sexuality, it's deeply metaphorical, right? And there's a lot of figurative language and a lot of repetition, and it's poetic, right? Whereas Gertrude, you know, and I know many of the people who are joining us haven't read this book, Gertrude writes about experiences of rape and incest. And I think the best word for her is just unvarnished, you know, unvarnished. I mean, unvarnished beyond like a Hemingway unvarnished, you know, because what she really wants, and I think you're right at the beginning of this book, is she is furious about what's happened to her, but also she has a sense that what has happened to her has happened to a lot of women and girls, right? She's constantly comparing her family to other families around her when she's growing up. And in a later article, I was one of 13 white trash, when she says that, you know, there's this category of women like me. So she's so mad about that. She just wants to get it out there. So it's hard to, and I think this is partly why she stayed out of print for so long until you guys came along and did this, you know, I've got it sitting right here. This book is because she's just so straightforward. And, you know, the autobiography and autobiographical fiction, this is a memoir, but autobiographical fiction is definitely a feature of modernist writing. Like if you think of the major modernists, you can be like, okay, you've got Joyce and you've got Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. You've got Wolfe and you've got, you know, To the Lighthouse. There's all these autobiographical elements. But she's writing this autobiography that starts with, you know, dirt poor Texas and ends with, I'm on a ship to Japan. And it spans so much that it's just really hard to compare her to anybody else. You know, she's definitely of her moment in writing about the things she writes about. Like, it's true in the 20s, people want to think about sexuality. So in that way, she's of her moment, but she's just so blunt and straightforward that I think that's partly why, you know, she's never been kind of brought into a modernist canon, which is very much about representation and about style. And, you know, I don't think Gertrude's even very interested in style. She is interested in telling her truth, you know, and getting it out, as you say, in a memoir that changes from the beginning to the end.
Absolutely. I mean, one of my most recent discoveries, I tend to periodically Google stalk Gertrude, just find, I wish I had librarian like Google stalking capabilities, because librarians are like magicians. But one of the items that I came across recently was a letter that Hemingway wrote to Ezra Pound about the book. I believe that Ezra Pound's letter initiating conversation has been lost, but essentially what you can read between the lines is that Ezra Pound was quite taken with the book. And I think he really liked the unvarnished. He really liked that here was someone who was willing to dismantle, he didn't use these words, but I'm going to use it, the myth of American exceptionalism. You know, again, this in this particular time and space, this was someone who had no time for mythologies or nostalgia or, you know, the Norman Rockwell version of Americana. And he was very taken with that. And Hemingway, being Hemingway, was rather disparaging, not of Gertrude necessarily, but of the memoir genre as a whole. Because, I mean, it's Hemingway. And I think one of the interesting things, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, as Marie and I have been talking to people, a number of reactions have surprised me. And maybe that's just because I love memoir as a genre. I read way too much of it. Is that a number of folks have responded, well, how, I don't even know how to take this because you're only getting one side of the story. You know, how do I interpret this? How can I believe what she's saying? Mm-hmm. And this isn't just a modern reaction to the book. I mean, that's part of why when it was banned in both the UK and later in the US, you know, part of that was related to the fact that this was obscene material and couldn't be passed through the mails, which I just love the plural of mails. But part of it was also down here in Texas. I mean, she named names, like she was not, you know, to protect the innocent or to protect the guilty, you know, and it just so happened that one of the people that she gently accused of having an affair with her local church preacher happened to be the mother-in-law of the governor. And so needless to say, her book was definitely on the unknown blacklist. We were quite amused that there was a wonderful article that Texas Monthly put out for its publication 2 months ago. And a gentleman responded to that article who was the son of a very famous, down here in Texas, a very famous rare bookseller. And he was like, yeah, that guy that you're talking about in the article, the one who placed a copy of Gertrude's book in the UT Austin library system and then got summoned in front of the Texas legislature's un-American activities, you know, to basically ask, why on earth did you do that? And how fastly can we get the books off the shelves? Like, that was my dad. It was the unspoken truth that people were out to get this book and it was not allowed anywhere. Anyways, but I think the part that I have come up short on is when we get that reaction of, well, it's memoir, it's only one side of the story. I've really struggled with that because, first off, yes, absolutely. But on the other hand, that just carries so many echoes of how many other women have had their stories not believed, particularly their stories that are inconvenient stories or stories about, you know, trauma, stories about sexual trauma. And in Gertrude's case, this was a story that all of it was just beyond the pale and was just too inconvenient. And not only could her story itself not circulate, she as a writer couldn't frankly be allowed to continue. These were not stories to be told. So my question to both of you is really, how do you find it problematic that this is memoir versus any other more formal, more credible piece of writing? And if not, why?
Well, you know, it's just fascinating that you get that reaction, you know, because, I would just want to follow up with those people and say, well, you know, I mean, you do realize fiction's made up too, right? So what are you asking for? And, you know, if you want a history book that would document what happened to Gertrude, well, that's never going to happen, right? Because no third party is going to take someone like Gertrude as the subject for a text. So, you know, it's very strange that people seem to want to defend this family. And if you read the book, I mean, the things that the family did, right? There's bestiality. There's all kinds of craziness. You know, one daughter ends up in a brothel and almost dies giving birth to a baby. And we don't know why exactly she ends up in the brothel, but she does. I would say Gertrude did not have a lot to gain by lying, you know. This is her first and only book. And, you know, I don't think that there's any sense that she was going to capitalize on something by making the story more extreme than it was. One of the things I find fascinating, I think Bert Ullman in his book, That Stubborn Self, is the one who points out her mother was still alive when this book came out. She was living in California with one of her other daughters. But her mother, even though there's that lovely scene that Marie gestured toward, you know, where her mother visits while she's at the University of Chicago, and they have a really nice visit, and they're quite teary at having to be separated. But her mother does not look good, you know, for the first two thirds of the memoir. So she had a lot to lose by writing this book. You know, she's going to burn a ton of whatever bridges she still has with members of her family. And again, anybody who's writing, unless you've got a historian who's sitting in the archive all day long and not going to look at Gertrude, anybody who's writing is offering a representation of what life looks like to them. And this is what Gertrude's life looked like to her, you know, through her first 30 years.
And that's what I find is so powerful. It's like you know far better than I do what other women-centered perspectives we have on that time and that place. And I appreciate that when I say that time and that place, it's like, well, are we talking about West Texas? Are we talking about Chicago? Are we talking about Washington? Are we talking about Paris? You know, what other women-centered perspectives could you read as a companion piece to Gertrude?
I mean, I think there's nothing, you know. I struggled with this when I was writing the article on her. You know, people will sometimes point to Juna Barnes, who also had an incredibly unorthodox upbringing. She had a father who tried to start his own polygamous kind of religious practice. His mistress and his wife shared a house. She wrote a text based on it called Rider, but it's highly fanciful and highly, you know, worked up, and, you know, no one entirely knows which parts are from Juna's imagination and which parts are based in autobiography. So there's that, but the style is so ornate and elliptical that even getting at exactly what's happening is very different, you know. The other writer that I sometimes think about with her is Virginia Woolf, who published or didn't publish, who wrote memoirs. She was in a memoir club and they would read their memoirs to each other. She wrote memoirs about the experience of being molested by her older brothers. And, you know, those memoirs are rightly celebrated by many critics, you know, from the 70s, 80s, about Woolf daring to tell the truth about what it's like to be abused. But Woolf didn't publish them during her lifetime. And, you know, I mean, very different circumstances. So it's very, I really feel like Gertrude is kind of like by herself. You know, we have this kind of network of writers we can think about when we think about the early 20th century. And then here's Gertrude like floating out, you know, by herself. I mean, it's just a miracle this book got written at all.
Yeah. It's a miracle that it got written. And frankly, it's a miracle that it got preserved. You know, none of us would be even having this conversation. I mean, maybe you know more about this than I do. None of us would be even having this conversation if some point in the 80s, you know, some folks who were interested in, I believe this happened in Texas, that folks in Texas who were interested in the conversation about demythologizing the West, you know, like we have all the Western films, you know, about bravado, about the Indian fights, about whatever. And then you have related but separately all this lore about the frontier family life and, you know, ma and pa and, you know, your churning of butter and, you know, happy family of kids and just breaking that mythology down. Partly because that's what we were doing to all of our stories in that late 60s, but definitely the 70s time period. It's sort of that questioning that's turning the story inside out. Mm-hmm. And I guess I don't know who put the book in Larry McMurtry's hands, but thank goodness someone did. And then, you know, right after he published Lonesome Dove, you know, and he, you know, was getting all of this credibility, all of this fame, and he helped play a role to get it, to get Gertrude's memoir republished, very limited edition. That's the copy that I'm holding here. And the woodcuts in this were just so gorgeous, really just fantastic, but only 500 copies were published. Mm-hmm. So it remained incredibly difficult to get your hands on a copy. Now, one thing that I am curious about is, you know, Celia, when you discovered this and read it, you were coming at it with this background in modernist literature and women's literature and what was happening with censorship in Britain in that time period. You know, when I picked this up, I was coming at this from a headspace where I was trying to understand Western literature and demythologizing and what are the American myths and what do they look like when they're turned on their head? So like we were both coming with these specific lenses. Marie, you just got this dumped on your lap. I mean, I pretty much just dumped it on your lap.
Not pretty much. You just dumped this. We were having all these family Zoom calls during COVID, and I popped on a few minutes later to one of them, and I picked up with, and Marie can edit the book.
Thank you. But talk a little bit about first what that was like coming at this cult, mm-hmm. and also what it was like what was it like as a reader and what was it like to edit it for a reissue?
Well, editing a deceased author is definitely a different beast than editing a live author where you can actually have conversations and you can ask questions and you can make suggestions. So obviously there was very little that could actually be done editorially. I mean, a big part, when I say I edited the book, a big part of it was cleaning up the scan of the manuscript of that, the book that you guys both have the copy of, that was initially published. So that was a big part of it, though there was, so I mean, in terms of the actual work that I did on the book, the first probably week or two was just sort of cleaning up the manuscript and getting the scans readable, because there were all kinds of issues just with the technology with that. And then some things, like she would have these sentences or paragraphs that would just go on for pages, and I would get kind of, I'm like, is this Melville? Like, what am I reading? I can't, I'm getting lost in the middle of it. So, you know, there was some, and my editor at Sourcebooks, and we were going back and forth a bit with, can I put in paragraph break? Can we, you know, just little things like that, some spellings that we unified throughout and so on. So so from an editorial standpoint, it was, you know, obviously not actual editing. It was more sort of copy editing, I think, from that standpoint. I remember I didn't know much about the book, and Nina said, here you go. And I, you know, I got the copy and I read the first paragraph and I said, holy wow, what is this book, Nina? What did you find us? So, I mean, it was definitely a tough book to read. And normally I'm pretty good at, when I'm editing, is I can just, you know, you read it from an editorial standpoint. And this one, I would sort of get roped into the story and say, oh, shoot, I didn't actually edit the last two pages. Let me go back and actually do what I'm supposed to be doing, as opposed to, you know, just reading. I probably should have just read it first and then gone back and did that. So it was definitely, she's definitely a powerful writer. I know we had one question in the Q&A that I just wanted to address quickly, which was that Gertrude is not a particularly likable person in terms of like sympathizing. Yeah, it's a difficult narrator to sympathize with. And Nina and I have talked about this before, and that if we knew Gertrude, if we were her contemporaries, I'm not sure we'd actually be friends with her. Like, she is definitely a very abrasive personality. And so I think that's an interesting question too. And also just the bigger issue of the value of someone's voice when it's someone we don't find particularly likable on sort of a personal level. You know, do those voices still have value? Which I think is an interesting question as well.
And, you know, to that too, I want to say we often expect women in particular to be likable, right? To play nice.
Right.
And certainly her culture, you know, expected that. And so in part, you know, my discomfort with her is about socialization that even, you know, a century later still directs some of how we operate in the world. I mean, she does not, I don't think she cares if you like her. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think she wants, you know, I think she would have wanted us to keep reading, but I don't think she cares if you like her. It's really, it's, you know, and how could somebody from that background be likable? Right. I mean, how could somebody from that background be polished? You know, she's not, you know, I mean, she has to fight for every little thing she got. So, so yeah.
She doesn't have any time or energy. I think that was part of what I found so moving was she has no patience. Like, she has no patience for anyone who would tell her, oh, a fulfilled life for a woman is to have a husband and have a family, or you shouldn't be a professional, or you should be content to stay, you know, near your, like, she has no patience for anyone who would tell her what she is experiencing or what she should feel. I think the last question that I'd like us to think about is the parts that are still incredibly uncomfortable for 21st century readers, you know, because some of the things that in the 1920s were uncomfortable are things that we cheer on today. You know, this is a woman who is who knows her own worth and who is able to articulate her anger and is able to stand up for herself and is able to be ambitious, you know, and is able to carve out her own path and is anti-authoritarian. And like, we just love that, you know, that's become very comfortable for us to read about. But there's a number of items here where it's like, I'm not sure I want to be associated with that. And one of the things that makes me think of, there was a question in the chat about curious whether there was any hesitancy to take on this book and to reissue this book. And I would say, I'd like, you know, Marie, your perspective on that. We're both sitting here. For those in the audience who don't know, my mother-in-law, Marie's stepmother, is Dominique Rocca. She owns the publishing company Sourcebooks. Sourcebooks is the largest woman-owned publisher in the country. They're based just outside of Chicago, and they are really dedicated to telling stories of marginalized voices, particularly women, but not exclusively women. And so in many ways, this was, of course, this has to be republished. There's no question. I mean, it's a moral imperative. But that said, there's absolutely still pieces in here that are very uncomfortable. Marie, Celia, would you like to touch on any of those?
Well, I remember with one of the, and I haven't read that part in a while, so I can't remember exactly, but there's a couple passages that are fairly racist. And I remember just thinking, I was like, can we just edit that out? Can we, you know, which you can't, obviously. But I mean, so yeah, there were definitely some like uncomfortable making moments, you know, and as much as she was sort of a pioneer in so many ways and going against what was expected of her in a lot of ways, like some of her more racist views, that was sort of in society and in culture at the time. And so there were definitely things going on that she just sort of agreed with and went along with, I think without questioning it, probably. There was a lot that she did question, and that's, I think, the parts that were like, go Gertrude. But yeah, there are definitely some uncomfortable, I mean, there are moments, you know, about sexual abuse and so on that make us uncomfortable because of the subject matter. But then I think some of Gertrude's, you know, especially the more racist, a couple of the racist comments. It's not like the book is full of it, but she's got a couple moments when you're like, oof, you know, so those definitely stood out to me. I mean, it didn't impact our desire to get the book back out there in the world, I think. But there are definitely some more cringeworthy, I think, moments in the book. Celia, how about you? What do you?
Well, you know, and so many of them happen in Chicago. You know, it's interesting because it's only once she's in Chicago that she has to confront race. I think in the mm-hmm. South, I mean, she doesn't even write about it because they don't even think about it, right? There's just a way things are. So, you know, there's a moment where you cheer for her because she goes to the University of Chicago and she goes to a pool. I think it's on campus. Mm-hmm. And she realizes it's an integrated pool, right? Yeah. There are African-American students swimming in it. And she pauses for a moment and then she gets in the pool, you know, and you think, okay, you know, so this is somebody who could like, you know, and she says at that moment, I realized I had never read an unprejudiced account of the African-American question. And so there are moments where you think, okay, this is going to be a story of someone who learns. And then just a few pages later, someone in the college finds a story about a lynching in Texas. And they say to her, aren't your people civilized? And she defends the need for lynching specifically because of interracial rape. And she actually gets the name, right? Lyncher or something like
yes. that. Yes, that's what they call her. That was her right. nickname at University of Chicago.
Yeah, and I think that's such a telling moment because you know, what you see is she's just written this memoir. She's in the middle of writing this memoir about being abused by her brothers, right? And showing that sexual violence is in the Southern white family, right? But somehow when challenged by students in the North, she feels the need to defend, you know, her Southernness and to defend it from this charge. And she does it really badly, you know, and part of, I guess, what I like about this book in some ways is that it's rough. I wonder if her initial editor, I'm coming back to your comment, Marie, about editing her. I mean, when he writes about her in his memoir, he says that she was temperamental. And I wonder if her initial editor tried to get her to cut anything or make those paragraphs or what he tried to get her to do, but she was temperamental with him. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there are lots of moments like that. There's also the moment where she accepts when a doctor tells her that she's having health problems because she's a woman and she's thinking too much and it's affecting her womb. And you just think, Gertrude, you know, how could you just accept that? I mean, she just accepts it. So
well, the way to solve those particular gynecological problems was to get married and have a child. I mean, that's right. What the doctor told her. Like, this is the solution to your gynecological problems that may, can I just posit, may have been brought on by all the childhood rape.
Yeah.
Just a theory, but it can be solved by getting married because that's what respectable yeah. women did and having babies.
But, you know, I'll just say too, to the question, I just had a conversation in a classroom about we read a range of British literature this semester, and one of my students said, you know, it wasn't the topic, so we didn't talk about it a lot, but, you know, let's sit down and think about the racism that's in so many texts from the 20s and 30s. And it's sad, but it's there. It's pervasive, and that doesn't excuse it, but it's also not a reason not to republish a book.
I want to thank all of you for being here tonight for this wonderful discussion. Thank you, Celia and Marie and Nina. Thank you to everyone for being here. And we hope you visit AmericanWritersMuseum.org. And we'll see you at our events again soon. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, authors Jonathan Latham and Stacey Williams discuss their works and the craft of writing. Now go, be inspired. And find the mind of a writer in yourself.